This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thank you for joining us for our broadcast radio and online stream, Main Street, all across North Dakota this time of day. Today we'll begin our show with someone who's been a guest before. Dan Belinsky is the director of theater at the University of Mary, and he's joining us today to talk about a film project that is historically significant and very interesting to talk about. Dan, thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
The project is about the last lynching in North Dakota, which took place 90-some years ago, and its title is End of the Rope. Give us the background of this story, Dan.
So the screenplay is based on a history that was written by Dennis Johnson, who is a lawyer up in Watford City and a historian up there. It's an account of the true story of the last lynching in North Dakota. The man was Charles Bannon. He was a 21-year-old farmhand who killed an entire family on their farm in 1931 in Schaefer, North Dakota, which is just outside of Watford City. And he lived on their farm for almost a year afterwards, until the town became suspicious. Then they brought him in for questioning, and after some running around, they got him to confess, and they stormed the jail cell later and knocked on the door with a telephone pole, dragged him out of the cell, and threw him off a bridge with a rope around his neck. Afterwards, there was a big statewide investigation to try to find who was involved in this mob killing, but nobody squealed. Nobody ratted on their neighbor because either the whole town was involved or their brother or their uncle or their sister was. And so to this day, no one's been brought to trial for their participation in the killing of Charles Bannon.
What are the plans for filming? What's your schedule? I know you're auditioning, too.
Yeah, we just had local auditions in Watford City and in Bismarck. We had tremendous turnout. We saw over 500 people just here in North Dakota auditioning. And so we're also accepting auditions from larger markets, professional markets for the lead roles. And we're in the middle of casting now, but hopefully we'll wrap it up by the end of the month. We're planning to shoot in August, and so we're in pretty serious pre-production now.
And you're working with a Twin Cities filmmaker by the name of Charlie Griak. Who's doing what?
So Charlie is directing, and he's co-writing it with me. I'm the lead producer on the project. Charlie has he's made several feature films, including one that I was an actor in several years ago. And he and I shot another feature film called Lamentations last summer, which will be in theaters this coming fall. That's also a historical North Dakota film. But he's a great guy, a very talented artist, talented writer, director, and editor. And so we're very fortunate to be able to work with him.
Now, are you both working as sort of casting directors, or is that your job, or how is this being done?
So we've hired a casting director out of New York for some of the more significant roles. We've cast some of the other leading roles out of Minneapolis, and I've been working with talent agencies there. And then in North Dakota, I've essentially been acting as the casting director here. And we've had, like I said, we've had a tremendous outpouring of interested people.
Well, you've got at least a mob in this movie. How many people are you going to need? You're recreating a little town, too.
Yeah, we're recreating Schaefer, North Dakota from 1931. So, yeah, we do need the townspeople. We'll probably end up working with a cast of around, depending on the day, 50, 60.
Wow. So how many days do you expect to be shooting?
We'll be filming a month, 4 weeks.
So this is a full-length feature film, which would be 90 minutes plus or something like that?
Yeah, between 90 minutes and 2 hours.
What significant roles are you still looking for?
We're still casting our lead, the sheriff, C.A. Jacobson, and then a number of the minor parts. I'm just beginning to reach out to folks to make offers. So it's a little bit TBD right now.
Okay. To be determined. Dan Belinsky is the director of theater at the University of Mary. And you've done a number of these kind of creative projects beyond, shall we say, the stage, because you've got some film and TV background. Do students participate in these projects as well?
Yes, they do. They have a chance to participate on camera and behind camera for these productions. We are starting a new program at the University of Mary. Actually, the theater minor is growing to a dramatic arts major, and students will get credit for participating in the film. So we'll have students both on the crew and in the cast for this production, and it's a tremendous experience for them to be, for my acting students to get the chance to, you know, act in front of the camera and work with professionals and be mentored by these wonderful industry folks that we're bringing in.
Now, you're recreating a period, the 1930s, the early 30s. You're building that small town set to be Schaefer, which is, and Schaefer isn't much of anything these days. You've got costumes, you've got cars, you've got, you know, all kinds of stuff. Who's in charge of all of that?
So we hired a wonderful production designer out of Minnesota. His name is John Paul, and he worked on the movies Fargo and Grumpier Old Men and Jingle All the Way with Arnold Schwarzenegger. So he's a wonderful, wonderful artist. And then we're also working with Brad Reisig, who's the set designer and the technical director at the UND in Grand Forks. For the theater program, I mean, the set designer for the theater program there. And he's also a wonderful addition to the team as art director.
The online database, the IMDb, has a blurb here that describes the film project as, when a sociopathic hired hand murders an entire family, the town of Schaefer, North Dakota, rises up to take justice into their own hands based on the true story of the infamous Charles Bannon case of 1931. Telling the story of a lynching requires, you know, setting the scene and taking the temperature, if you will, of the people who were around this incident when it happened. How do you do that?
Yeah, it's a delicate matter, obviously, and I think the first thing that I always try to clear up is that it's not race related at all. This was white people hanging a white guy.
Yes.
I think, you know, it starts with the people who are closest to the story, which is a special aspect of just this process of turning this into a film, because there, you know, if you go to McKenzie County, anybody who's a real native of that county knows the story of the Charles Bannon case, and most of them have some kind of personal connection to it. So they're grandfather was, was involved in some way. And I've spent a lot of time in McKenzie County just over the past year and gotten to know a lot of the folks up there. And they're just thrilled that this is being turned into a story, into a movie. And they've all got their own contributions. So they'll pull me aside and they'll tell me, this is what my mother told me. I've never told anybody this before, but I wanted to tell you so you could, you know, possibly use it in the movie. And so it's an honor and it's a responsibility to tell a true story and to do justice to the people that were involved and their descendants who are alive today, who have a personal stake in the story and who are supporting us in many ways to make this film.
That's one of the interesting mysteries about a story like this, Dan, because you say so many people must have known. Governor George mm-hmm. Schaefer at the time, according to the North Dakota Supreme Court website, launched an investigation, called it an outrage. There was a national church organization that looked into it as well.
Uh-huh.
How could they not know who might have been involved?
I think everybody in town did know. I think it points towards a really interesting aspect of the story in that this was a very isolated community. So the northwest corner of the state there was known at that point as the Island Empire. It was cut off on three sides by water. There was no bridge going over the river there. And this was a very isolated community, you know, one generation away from the homesteading era. People were very much used to taking care of themselves. And if there was a problem, they dealt with it in their community. Bismarck might as well have been Chicago. It was that far away. So when problems come, and you know, when this man Charles Bannon kills a family, the people have a really legitimate concern for their community, and worried about, you know, Charles Bannon not getting justice if they pack him off to Bismarck and him coming back and, you know, hurting their families. I think the fact that he lived almost a year on his victim's farm without people bringing him to task or suspecting that there's foul play really spooked them. And it speaks to the limited communication of the time, because Charles Bannon said, oh, well, the family moved to Oregon. And so they would send messages to Oregon, telegrams, you know, and then the people in Oregon would, you know, it would take them a couple months and be like, no, we haven't seen them here. And then they would send a telegram back to Williston or wherever there was a telegraph office and be like, okay, well, they don't see him here. What do you think? And then there would be back and forth, you know, telegram messages that would just eat up months and months. And meanwhile, he's just living on the farm. And so I think that was a scary thing for people. They were scared for themselves and their families. And I think it's good to think of these people who were involved in the mob killing. Yes, there might have been some who just were violent people, or maybe they were drunk on that night. But these were also just good people making really difficult moral decisions to protect their family. And that's a really just interesting aspect of this story to me, and one of the elements that we're certainly going to explore with the film, this kind of, you know, what is it? Justice can be murky sometimes.
His father, James Bannon, was working on that farm mm-hmm. with him. James Bannon, interestingly enough, heads off to Oregon himself to go look for the Haven family members. At least that's the understanding in the North Dakota Supreme Court telling of the story. And yet he ends up in the penitentiary. His son is lynched and he ends up with a life sentence.
Yeah, he was accused of being complicit. And he wrote a few letters to Charles Bannon that seemed to imply that he knew what was going on as well and was just kind of protecting him. I believe he was present in the actual jail when they took Charles out. They knocked the door in with a telephone pole, both the door of Schaefer Jail and then the cell door as well, and they dragged him out, and his father watched that.
And I believe, at least according to one account, that Charles implored people not to hurt his father.
Yeah, I think that's one of those things where it's like in some of the accounts and in other accounts it's left out. It's one of those things that may or may not be true.
Well, nevertheless, Charles Bannon did confess. I think he confessed more than once. So why wasn't that sufficient?
So the first time he said it was somebody else. The second time he half confessed. And then the third time he made a full confession. So it worked in stages.
And then in sort of a classic lynching story here, the sheriff and the deputy sheriff and other people are sort of overwhelmed by the lynch mob and are themselves put behind bars. And again, the question arises, how could they not know who was doing this, even if they were wearing hoods and all of that stuff?
That's a good question. I think we'll offer some suggestions, certainly in the movie, that I don't want to spoil, but I think realistically, we can also think that, you know, the sheriff and the deputy of the time, they had to think about their families too, and just what their, like, even if they were commissioned to, you know, defend Charles Bannon, what were their personal feelings about Charles Bannon? We don't really know what happened in that jail cell. We only hear, you know, lots of different accounts, but there's nothing that everyone agrees on.
You said that the screenplay is based on a history that was written by Dennis Johnson of Watford City. Is that the definitive history, or is there perhaps maybe this movie will spur one more stab at it while people can still remember what their mom or dad or grandparents said?
Yeah, well, I don't think anybody knows more about it than Dennis Johnson. He's been such a valuable resource for us as filmmakers, and it all started with, you know, me sitting at a table in his law office and talking about the story. So he is constantly revising the book. I think it's on its third edition, and you can buy it, I think, online or at the Pioneer Museum in Watford City. And he's always talking to new people. Even through this, like once this film was announced, some relatives of the Haven family, which was the family that was killed, and some relatives of the Bannons actually reached out to me, and I passed their info on to Dennis. And so I think he'll have plenty of new material for a fourth edition.
Okay. How is a project like this funded?
It's supported completely by folks here in North Dakota. There's just been, you know, in the same way we had just a tremendous outpouring of people interested in auditioning for the film, there's just been so many people who have been generous with us, supporting it financially. All people here in North Dakota, many of whom have a personal tie to the story. You know, most of these people are from McKenzie County, and they know Dennis, they know the story, and I've had lots of meetings with the folks up there, and yeah, they've just been, it's been really humbling and moving for me, the way that people are just willing to support us in big ways.
How do you get about distribution? I assume that a theater in Bismarck or Watford City, or for that matter Fargo or anywhere in the state, would welcome this film because it would bring people into the theater. But what about broader distribution?
Yeah, so we'll start with theatrical distribution across the state and even across the region in South Dakota, Montana, and Minnesota. And then we'll go after online distribution and film festivals as well. Charlie, our director, has had several films on different online platforms, and we'll have the film available for not only North Dakota, but for the world.
Will you be playing any roles in the, or a role in the movie?
No, I'm just producer. That's enough for me.
Okay. Is this movie being shot on film or is it video? How are you doing that?
We'll be shooting on digital. We have a DP cinematographer that is coming from New York, and he's wonderful. He shoots on a absolutely top-of-the-line camera, and it'll look beautiful. I think between the beautiful landscapes that we have, the amazing sets that we'll build, the great camera we have, the great cast that we'll have a good-looking film.
Okay. And are you telling the story sort of as a linear narrative? Are you getting sort of the before, the family's there, and maybe Charles Bannon's there, then something happens, then he gets arrested, then there's this aftermath? Is that the arc of the story, or does it just pick up a piece of that?
So the story is told from the perspective of the sheriff of the time, C.A. Jacobson. He's kind of our protagonist. And it's told through his lens as he struggles with what his moral responsibility is to do. Because on the one hand, he's friends with the Haven family that was killed. He has some righteous anger against Charles Bannon, but he also has his responsibilities as a sheriff. On the other hand, he's tasked with taking care of the town of Schaefer and McKenzie County, and he wants to preserve and protect these people who also have a lot of righteous anger, his friends in the town who have a lot of righteous anger against Charles Bannon for killing Albert Haven and the Haven family. And so he's kind of caught between a rock and a hard place, trying to decide what the right thing to do is here, whether to protect Charles Bannon or let the mob have its way, or to reveal the names of the mob members, or to keep it secret. He gives us a chance to really explore these difficult moral questions about, you know, what one should do in such a situation.
Well, one of the interesting sidelights to this story is that lynchings were used as an argument for capital punishment, because if you've got capital punishment, you won't have people running around looking for a rope if they get that angry. Do you explore that at all?
Well, that was certainly something that was brought up at the time, that there was no death penalty in North Dakota, and people just felt like Charles Bannon deserved to die. You think about a lot of these people, too, coming with old school traditions. Like I said, one generation from the Homesteading Act, from the homesteading era. So there were people there, you know, Germans from Russia, and there were Norwegians there who had, you know, built a sod house or, just homesteaded and built a farm and subsisted by themselves and just as really close-knit communities for the length of time that they'd been in North Dakota, for the past 20, 25 years. Now somebody is thrust into them who commits this terrible deed. And a lot of them just have old school values, too, like kind of an eye for an eye, tooth for tooth kind of thing. But then there was also genuine concern of, like, you know, will this guy, once we ship him off to Bismarck, the quote-unquote big city, will he get off? Will the lawyers, because it was all kind of murky, and he had multiple confessions, and I think they had a somewhat justified concern about him not getting the punishment that he deserved, whether it was life in prison or whatever. And the last thing they wanted was him back on the streets and coming after their families, you know.
The movie is End of the Rope. It will be shooting in the Watford City area later this summer in August and released in 2022. Dan Belinsky is the producer. He's working with director and writer, co-writer Charlie Griak. And he's also, of course, a University of Mary theater professor. Dan, always a pleasure to talk with you.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Bush Foundation, investing in great ideas and the people who power them, in Minnesota, North Dakota, South Dakota, and the 23 Native nations that share that same geography. Learn more at bushfoundation.org. On Prairie Public Primetime TV tonight.
Next time on Prairie Pulse, we'll talk with Dr. Ryan Yonk with the NDSU Center for the Study of Public Choice and Private Enterprise. He'll talk about the U.S. Constitution, and we'll profile two special Nepalese musicians. That's next time on Prairie Pulse.
Watch Prairie Pulse tonight at 8 Central, 7 Mountain on Prairie Public.
Coming up on Main Street, another episode of Telltale, Dakota Folk Life and Stories, and Main Street Eats with Sue Balcom. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. A bill to require public grade school and high school athletes to compete in sports according to their birth gender is now on its way to Governor Brigham's desk. The measure, worked out in a conference committee, includes a study. The conference committee's version of House Bill 1298 had passed the House earlier this week. Grand Forks Democratic Senator Joan Albaki said this is a measure to address a problem that doesn't exist.
We are interfering in a personal issue between a young adult, their parents, their doctor, and their God. It is none of our business.
Edinburgh Republican Senator Yana Murdahl argued it is a protective measure.
All we're asking is protecting girls that they play sports K-12 on an even playing field, and anybody can play sports. And this bill says in the sex of your or biological sex you're born with. So nobody's banning anything here. Nobody's taking any person's rights away. We're actually protecting rights.
The measure passed the Senate 27 to 20. By a single vote, the Senate has approved merging the state health department with the Department of Human Services. As amended in the Senate, House Bill 1247 calls for a gradual merger aided by an outside consultant. That consultant would be paid for through the use of federal COVID-19 relief funds. West Fargo Republican Senator Judy Lee chairs the Senate Human Services Committee. She told the Senate this would not result in immediate job cuts.
It's important to let the good people who are working in those departments know that there's not this immediate guillotine hanging over their head that their job is going to go away, but we want them to be engaged in the process of making the change.
But Fargo Republican Senator Ron Sorvag argued to keep those agencies separate.
They're more efficient because they're small. But again, I'll go back, it's transparency and accountable. And because there's an issue now and then between the two, at the end of the day, they are better to stand alone. We'll get a better bang for our buck in the long term.
The bill passed on a 24 to 23 vote. Unless reconsidered, it will go back to the House to see if it agrees with the Senate changes. And North Dakota's commercial airports saw a surge in demand during March.
We saw about 72,000 passengers in the month of March. Here in 2021, and it's about 22,000 more than in February.
State Aeronautics Commission Director Kyle Warner says that's the kind of trajectory he'd hope to see as summer travel season approaches.
People want to begin traveling again. They want to see family. They want to take a vacation, and they obviously want to do that in a safe way as well.
Warner says airlines are now easing some restrictions on planes. Delta has announced it would start seating passengers in middle seats again come June.
They need about a 70 to 80% load factor. And so that usually means that they need to start filling those middle seats as well. And so as we see airlines adding back flights and our communities are gaining more seat availability to be able to purchase ticket prices, that's a good thing for the industry so that it can once again return to profitability.
During the pandemic, Delta dropped its Williston to Minneapolis flight, but Warner says Delta will start flying that route again in June. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Recent wildfires in western North Dakota are a reminder of one of the biggest fears of early settlers. Today, in another episode of Telltale, Dakota Folklife and Stories, we'll hear about the threat of prairie fires from the descendants of our state's early settlers. Here's Telltale producer David Swenson.
Pioneer farmers who settled in southwestern North Dakota faced many challenges, including unpredictable weather, insect invasions, lack of trees for building, iron plows that broke when used on the hard prairie sod, and protecting their crops. As a young man, Charlie Miller talked to his elders about their greatest fears as pioneer farmers.
My elders, if you will, my grandfather and my great uncles and stuff like that. I really got to learn a lot from my great uncle from Duluth, Minnesota. And I says to him, Uncle Henry, I says, I want to ask you something. I says, what was your greatest fear? He was 2.5 years old when they came here. I said, what was your greatest fear when you guys homesteaded here? The families were still left in Strasburg and the dads came over, and took the homestead up and made sod homes. He says, the greatest fear, he says, if you can believe it or not, he says, was prairie fires. We all had plowed and disked everything around our farmsteads and our homesteads. If you've got a homestead here and you got a hayloft now, for example, buildings, you're going to make a fire guard all the way around that, what would you say? 100 feet? 120
feet? I'd say 100 feet.
Wide, yeah. All the way around your homestead, you don't think of it, till these guys were telling these stories, which this stuff was so high, he says. It was so thick, he says.
This tall, thick grass was the mixed grass prairie found in North Dakota, or buffalo grass, as many called it. And it caused the worries about prairie fires, but it did have its benefits. Buffalo grass is a drought-tolerant, protein-rich grass native to this area, and farmers and ranchers who grazed cattle on it noticed the difference.
Oh, that buffalo grass.
Yeah.
For some reason, you remember Gordy Ulmer.
Yeah.
because I don't know why these cattle up here are anywhere from 25 to 35 pounds heavier on the average than what ours are down by McLaughlin. And then Junior Joachim says, I can tell you. He says, my land up by Flasher doesn't have the good buffalo grass like this stuff down here. There was something about the grass down there that the cattle did, the calves did a lot better and in growth too, you know, it's weight. And of course, now when they'd come to McLaughlin, of course, these guys from Raleigh, they got premium sort of doggone calves in the fall. Buffalo grass, still originally, original buffalo grass. It's native.
Yeah, native.
You bet.
These native grasses were the foundation of the natural prairie found in North Dakota. They not only provided feed for cattle, they also provided homes, food, and cover to all manner of wildlife. Some of this wildlife was welcome, and some, well, not so much.
And the other thing I remember very clearly was when we were little kids, when we were planting corn, he'd say we would have to plant in front of the horses because there were so many rodents. Was it rabbits? Was it gophers, pocket gophers, whatever, mice? He says, by the time Dad came around with the team to cover the furrow, half the seed was gone. That's how many rodents there were. So then we had to plant right in front of the horses. And then, of course, then he'd bring the horses and through the dirt and the ground right over the top of the seed that where the rodents couldn't get it. They couldn't believe, like, the rabbits especially and the striped gophers, you know. It was unbelievable, all the rodents that were all in this country at that time.
Another trial pioneer farmers faced was the loneliness that they had to deal with. Good neighbors were precious, and they shared with each other more than one would expect.
Listening to my great uncle tell me stories about, I said, well, how did you get to learn to talk English? He says, well, there was no fences, so you had to herd your own cattle. If you had a quarter of land, you had to, and you had pasture. And he says, the girl next to us, bound our fence line, not fence line, but our boundary, they were Danish. She taught me Norwegian, and of course I didn't know how to talk English, and she could talk English. So she taught me English, and I taught her German. It's unbelievable how some of that could all materialize, you know.
Before the coming of farms, fields, and roads in North Dakota, prairie fires were common, and to the ecosystem, the benefits of prairie fire are enormous. They free nutrients in the soil and promote new, lush growth. It may no longer be the farmer's greatest fear, but that fear certainly continues to exist. Produced in partnership with Dakota Legacy, this project is supported in part by a grant from the North Dakota Council on the Arts, which receives funding from the North Dakota State Legislature and the National Endowment for the Arts.
Telltale, Dakota Folklife and Stories, is a collection of narratives describing the shared personal experiences and lore of the North Dakota Plains. It's supported by the State Council on the Arts. The stories feature interviews with senior citizens, many of whom are in elder care facilities. Narrator David Swenson owns Makoche Studios in Bismarck, where Telltale is produced. Next on the show, Main Street Eats.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming along with our members and other sources here on Prairie Public.
Support is provided by BNC National Bank, committed to building vibrant neighborhoods through support of civic organizations, arts and cultural programming, and youth activities. Learn more at bncbank.com.
I'm Dave Thompson. On this week's Legislative Review, West Fargo Republican Representative Mike Howe joins us to talk about some of the major issues to be resolved in this session, including spending levels for K-12 and higher education, as well as how the new federal COVID relief funds are going to be spent. Legislative Review, Friday at 6:30 p.m. Central on radio, as well as anytime on our digital platforms.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton with Ashley Thornburg. And because it's time for Main Street Eats, Sue Balcom.
Sue joins us once a week from her farm outside of Mandan, the Root Cellars Farm, to talk about food. And, you know, we spent 2 weeks ago talking mostly about cookies. Last week, we talked mostly about dessert paste. And so we're going to try and health it up a little bit better here. We're going to talk about some spelt.
Dessert paste sounds horrible.
I know it does. It really is delicious, that halva. But we thought maybe it's time to, you know, have some good superfood kinds of talking.
Superfood.
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's almost time for me to begin farmers markets again, and sourdough bread is one of my specialties. And I'm always looking for some other, you know, angle to take with my bread. And my husband had gotten this low FODMAP diet thing from his doctor to try. And they weren't supposed to eat wheat or bread, but it said it was okay to eat spelt, and it was really okay to eat spelt sourdough. Now, I did a little bit of research into it, and I think I know the reason why, but I did get 100 pounds of grain spelt that I ordered.
Wow.
And I love it. Mm. I love this flour, you guys. It is so much better than whole wheat sourdough, and you can actually, it has enough gluten in it so that you can actually use it like you would white flour when you're making a sourdough bread, and you get a good rise out of it, and it toasts up just fabulous.
Is it widely available?
I have not seen a lot of it at the grocery stores, but I order from Azure Standard, which is an organic company on the coast, and I do buy the whole grain and I grind it myself. I've never seen it as flour in the grocery store, but I have worked with people in Carrington at the research station. The NDSU research station in Carrington has done a lot of work with ancient grains, and spelt just happens to be a wheat that has not been hybrid or crossbred with anything. It's been cultivated since 5000 BC and was a staple food in Europe from the Bronze Age to the medieval times. And they're trying very hard at this research station to make these grains more available, because people who are gluten intolerant can handle these types of ancient grains like emmer. Emmer was one of the grains that my family's ancestors brought over from Russia when they came to North Dakota to farm. You know, they had the seeds sown in the hem of their skirts or the hems of their aprons because they needed something to get started, and it grew like crazy. But they called emmer wheat spelts with a Z on the end of it. So you want to make sure and not confuse spelt with the T on the end of it with this emmer wheat. And it used to irritate the guys at USDA because these Germans, if you know any good Germans, they're kind of stubborn bunch of people. They're like, we're not changing how we talk because of you. So they could never get them to call this by its proper name. So, but emmer is also an ancient grain that I've done some sourdough experimentation with. But the spelt is easier to get. Spelt is easier to get a hold of than the emmer. And hopefully these guys at Carrington will eventually be able to get more and more of these grains, some of which stem from NDSU research in at the college. You know, they do research on crops and things like that. And they've actually developed some of new wheat strains, but they've also kind of issued or provided some of these ancient grains to people to use back in the day, which are becoming more and more popular now.
Sue, if you were to compare spelt as flour, as you use it for, I guess, sourdough bread, what is significantly different about it than regular flour?
There's something about the proteins in the ancient grains that our modern wheat doesn't have. Another thing that's probably a huge difference, and I hope I do not offend anybody by saying this, but I don't think that spelt is grown the way the wheat nowadays is sprayed with glyphosates to kill it off so they can harvest it when they want to harvest it, which an ancient grain is probably grown with more organic ways. And they're very closely related nutritionally. So if you are a celiac, you can't be eating this. But spelt contains calcium, selenium, and more vitamins than the wheat that you find in the grocery stores nowadays. It's higher in zinc and protein, too. But there's a difference in the way that these grains, these hybrid grains, are not agreeing with people's guts because they have other grains mixed in with them, or they've been bred with other grains, like a barley or something. They're not a true whole wheat. And I might not be saying this scientifically enough for some people, but I know in my head what I'm talking about. So you'll have to bear with me there. It has a little less fiber in it than whole wheat does, but that's part of this too, is what is soluble fiber and how that is absorbed into your body and how it affects your blood sugar, which is why it's on the FODMAP thing. And FODMAPs, if you're doing one of those glycemic index diets, you know, based on the type of person that you are, then this is easier for you to digest, probably releases its carbs slower so that you don't have a spike in your blood sugar. But, you know, it's a little more like an oatmeal is better for you than wheat because of the way that it is absorbed in your body. So additionally, of course, when you're making sourdough bread, you're breaking down some of those proteins in that grain while you're fermenting it. And that's one of the reasons why people can eat sourdough bread, even though sometimes they're a little more sensitive to the stuff in the grocery store shelves. But this, I'm telling you, this spelt is going to be like magic for me this summer, because there's always people looking for a whole grain sourdough. And of course, that's a heavy bread, but this stuff is just wonderful. And it's brown, so it's a beautiful brown color. And it's so soft when you're done, and it rises so high that I can't wait to use it for like noodles. I'm going to try some spelt noodles for us to eat when we're trying to avoid gluten in our household, which is really hard to do because like it comes out from under my fingernails all the time.
when you're using the spelt flour instead of the more commercially prepared wheat flours that we have readily available, have you had to adjust the recipes in any way, like more liquid, less liquid, more time to rise? Mm.
Anytime that you're using any, and because you can't find this, that you're going to have to grind it yourself, fresh ground, even fresh ground white wheat or whole wheat flour, you have to remember that it is a little less dense. So it's a little airier in the first place. So you would have to probably reduce the amount of liquid that you use. But when I always tell people, like I'm teaching a class in sourdough bread again in April, and I have to convey to people that it's not a recipe. You know, they get so mad at me because they're like, I want a recipe. You never give out recipes. I said, A, my learning to cook was an oral tradition. And so I'm trying to pass that on as an oral tradition. And secondly, sourdough is a method. It's not, there's not really a recipe. And I got kind of like admonished by some guy at a class that I taught because I didn't use a scale and I didn't do this quote unquote scientifically. And I'm like, in my mind, there's nothing scientific about this. It's a feel. And if your bread doesn't turn out, it's because you didn't love it enough when you were putting it together. So when you are using fresh ground wheat or white flour, you do want to kind of adjust the amount of liquid that you put in there. It's a lot airier, and it will make a fluffier bread that way too. You know, the less water you use in a sourdough, the better.
How about, can you substitute spelt for wheat in anything you cook? Would you do that, or would you specify it for certain kinds of baked goods?
Nope, absolutely. I would definitely give it a try. You will love the flavor. It's so wonderful. I'm not kidding you. I haven't been so impressed by a grain in a long time as I was with when I started using this spelt. And I was delighted to be able to find it from Azure Standard. There's probably other places where you can buy it as a whole grain. And someday I would love to see grocery store shelves stocked with all kinds of ancient grains.
Bob's Red Mill has a fair amount.
Oh,
yeah.
You know what? Really, that might be a place to find that. But it's so, always in such small packages.
Yeah. It's true.
You know, like 5 pounds of flour doesn't mean no good at all.
Right.
They don't even have to bother with the 5-pound bags.
Well, you said that you end up always buying the grain and grinding it yourself. Are you able to do that with a standard blender that you can get at Target, or do you have to have something more specialized?
You could use a blender. I've made oat flour in blender for a long, long time. However, you're going to wear that thing out. Grains are tough. And if you want to, you can actually buy an attachment for a KitchenAid mixer that works just fine for household use. Those are probably, well, when I bought mine, it was about $75. They've probably gone up since then. But I finally broke down and bought a Nutri-Grain grinder or mill. But my big mistake there was it runs on electricity. It was less than $200, and I really should have gotten a hand crank one. You know, in the event of a zombie apocalypse, we're not going to have electricity, and I still don't want to have to go out and get a couple of big flat stones to grind grain to make bread. So that's my take on spelt. I would give it a try if I were you, because, and actually buying grain, just a couple things about buying 25-pound bags of grains. Montana Wheat, which is a favorite company of mine, you can buy that through big box stores or directly from their company. If you buy a 25-pound bag of grain, you've got a grain that'll last you for 3 years if properly stored away from the light, away from heat. You should use fresh ground grains within 3 days of grinding them. The oils in those grains go rancid. You know, they're not processed in any way at all. They're straight off the head of the grain that grows out in the field. And so you've got, if you're like storing up food, you know, just because you're that kind of person, you'll want to buy a whole grain. It'll last way longer than a flour. You won't have to put it in the freezer. We keep it in the root cellar with everything else in a plastic bin that's food grade so that the mice can't get in there, because they like that stuff too, you know. And Azure Standard is a very conscientious company, and they use paper bags when they ship your grain to you. And it's less expensive to buy a 25-pound bag of spelt or emmer or any of those ancient grains than it is to buy it ground into flour. And I'm not sure what the reason is, except that the mills probably aren't set up to do so many different types of grains. That's my only thing on that. I just don't know.
We've learned about spelt with Sue Balcom. We check in with Sue every week for Main Street Eats. Thank you, Sue.
Thank you very much. It was my pleasure.
Dakota Datebook is next.
This is Dakota Datebook for April 15th. Dr. Herbert Wilson was born in Bethel, Vermont on this date in 1921. Wilson was a physician at Fort Berthold for 43 years before retiring. Herbert's college education was interrupted by World War II, which turned his life in a new direction. He served on B-24s as a navigator and gunner. While in England, he met Lillian May Osborne, a corporal in the Women's Auxiliary Air Force. They married in 1945. Wilson went to Harvard, then Tufts Medical School. Upon completing his government-subsidized education, Wilson was ordered to serve 1 year on the Fort Berthold Reservation. He and his family arrived in Elba Woods on a hot August day in 1951.
The people of Fort Berthold were undergoing a major upheaval with the pending loss of their homes and rich bottomlands to the Garrison Dam and its subsequent reservoir, Lake Sacagawea. The Elbowoods Hospital had been closed, and people were being urged to use an innovative off-reservation care program. But many had turned back to traditional medicine. Babies were being born at home. Lacerations were filled with sage rather than being sutured. Tuberculosis was a significant problem at the time. Dr. Wilson reported, "In my first year, two infants came down with tubercular meningitis. One survived, one succumbed." Much of the doctor's practice consisted of setting broken bones and treating cuts and bruises. When his year was up, Wilson realized his patients were more restless and troubled than ever. The Wilsons decided to stay and open a part-time private practice that would include non-Indians. Their second year led to a third to a fourth, and finally, 43 years after the move to the Missouri River bottomlands, it was time for a rest. Finding it difficult to slow down, the Wilsons retired in a more urban setting, Bismarck, and he remained active. He opened a weekly free medical clinic in Selfridge, ran for the state legislature, volunteered with the State Heritage Center and the Crisis Hotline, and served on the board of the former governor's mansion. He joined numerous Bible study groups, Kiwanis, Physicians for Peace, and the American Lung Association. On June 1st, 2020, Dr. Herbert Wilson passed away at the age of 99. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Mary Helm. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
U.S. troops will withdraw from Afghanistan by September.
We went to Afghanistan because of a horrific attack that happened 20 years ago. That cannot explain why we should remain there in 2021.
What national security concerns might the Biden administration focus on now? New foreign policy priorities on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
Thank you for joining us today for Main Street. As we broadcast, we stream online at prairiepublic.org. And after the broadcaster stream, you can find Main Street shows archived as podcasts at prairiepublic.org. Friday on our show, we'll hear about working in Indian country. It's a virtual series to help support working relationships in Native and non-Native communities. Strengthen ND's Executive Director Megan Laudenschlager and series facilitator Larry Keown will discuss it with our Ashley Thornburg. News Director Dave Thompson will review the week's big stories, and Matt Olin will review Hillbilly Elegy. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Friday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.